Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's surgery endorsement conference call. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, for opening remarks and introductions, I would like to turn the call over to Alexis Foreman. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and welcome to our surgery endorsement maintenance work group B conference call. And I noticed that we do have measure developer representation from the ACC. Do we have anyone from ARC available, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality? Okay, and do we have representation from the Society for Vascular Surgery? Okay, well, again, I'd like to welcome everyone to the call, and I will now turn the call over to Melinda Murphy.
Thanks, Alexis. So just a couple of things as refreshers. You've been through this drill before when we were getting ready for phase one measure review. And the objective of the meeting is for the group members to be able to look at the way in which each of you evaluated the measures as a preliminary evaluation and have a conversation about any of the items that you evaluated or any of the comments that were made by members of the group for purpose of clarification or just to be comfortable as a group about where you're starting into the review of these measures for the steering committee meeting. It's also your opportunity to give a heads up to any of the developers who are on the line about items that you may want to have additional information about or items that you know you want to pursue further at the steering committee meeting. The developers were not asked to be prepared to respond to any questions today, but rather to just have the opportunity to hear your discussion and to take away any comments or follow-up items that you might have for them in preparation for the face-to-face meeting. Any questions about that? Okay, so then just a couple of comments about your role as a discussion leader at the committee meeting itself. As you will recall, each person who was assigned as a primary reviewer for a measure is the individual who will lead off the discussion of that measure at the steering committee meeting. And in leading off the discussion, what you're asked to do is present the number and title of the measure, a brief description of the measure, and the way in which the work group, you and the work group, evaluated the measure in your preliminary review. And what we will ask of the steering committee as a whole is that each of the criteria, each of the four major criteria, be spoken to very clearly in terms of the rationale for the way in which the criterion is rated for the individual measures. Any questions about that? If not, then what we believe, and Alexis, correct me if I'm wrong, is that two of the members of the work group were not able to join today?
Yes.
Okay, so Chris Sagel and Nick Sears were not able to join today. And the way in which we'll proceed, unless there's a member of the work group or members of the work group who would like to do it differently, is that we'll go ahead and have those of you present present your measures for discussion, and that's a total of four. And then as a group, you can look at the way in which the remaining four were evaluated and offer your additional comments about those. So if that sounds acceptable, then Vivian Halpern, you would be first up.
Oh, lucky me. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so I think I'm doing 1534 and 1523.
Correct.
Okay. So 1534 is in-hospital mortality following elective endovascular, EVAR means endovascular aneurysm repair of small aneurysms. And the proposal is to look at the in-hospital mortality of patients who die after this procedure is done. And it was proposed to look both at hospitals and individual providers. And it's from the Society for Vascular Surgery. And they felt small aneurysms, the other measure is similar, but it's for open. But they felt small aneurysms were more important because there's actually the lower end of aneurysm repair. There is some controversy as to what kind of patients should actually get done. And so it's sort of to oversee quality and improvement on those aneurysms where the risk of rupture is under 10% per year. So basically, they are going to do this through the databases that it already exists in the New England Vascular Group, which covers Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Connecticut, and has been adopted by the Society for Vascular Surgery as their quality improvement database. And they would use the data in that to look through this data. Okay. Do we have up? I just lost my link. Oh, here we go. I'm trying to get up the graph of everybody's comments. So from the perspective of qualification for the measure, there is an opportunity for improvement in terms of ensuring that patients receiving operations for small aneurysms are being done appropriately. In terms of scientific acceptability, it's a they're really just looking at mortality. It would be they don't feel that it needs to be risk adjusted. There was no risk adjustment done. For testing and analysis, 100 patient records from five procedures for the representing the five procedures relevant to the small endovascular aneurysm measurement. I think that's through CPT codes rather, and they were going to measure five different hospitals based on data collected during the prior 2 years. In addition, in-hospital mortality was going to be examined by claims analysis of 7,205 patients discharged and recorded in the New England Vascular Registry base from 2003 to 2007. They were going to have a nurse abstractor looking through the chart, the Kappa statistics. Were going to be used to judge the reliability of the data, and for the mortality validation, claims data from each of the 12 hospitals were matched to a patient identified data within the vascular registry to compare the discharge status to ensure that the data is actually correct. They wanted to exclude the larger aneurysms because, again, there is data that says that there are several large trials that show that it's safe to observe smaller aneurysms less than 5.5 centimeters. They designed this, and again, in terms of risk adjustment, they designed it specifically to avoid the need for risk adjustment in small aneurysms with low risk, with a low rupture risk. It is they felt it was incumbent on the surgeon to factor in any risk benefit, and that you really shouldn't have any deaths, basically, if you're doing it for a small aneurysm. In terms of usability, they do have the SVS vascular database and the New England Group vascular database. So they have access to all the data very easily. It should be feasible because it's not complex data that they're collecting to do this measure. And I think that's about all of it. I'm still having problems linking to the graph.
To see what other people had said.
Is it up on your screen? Are you able to see it on your screen?
I keep losing contact. Did that come through to us in one of the emails? I'm trying to see if I have it in an email.
It did. Alexis, can you remind us when that was sent?
I got it. I found it. Okay.
Okay, good.
This makes it easier for me to view. Sure. Let me just get down to this one. I'm on 1534. So others also, they wondered about the 30 days. Let's see. Ooh, what just happened there? All right, just accidentally shut this out. I'm not seeing Dr. Seagal said there was no details on how scores. I don't know what that means for him. And they wanted to know that measures only. I'm not sure what these comments all were referring to, but most people felt that it should be approved as a measure. Any other comments? I'm not sure what Dr. Seagal meant, no detail has of scores, of how scores.
I think you're not seeing it, seeing all of it. It says no details on how scores are presented is available.
I'm not sure what.
So in the area of scientific acceptability, I think he was looking for some information on how the scores that are...
Well, the score is either death or no death.
Yeah. But in some, whether he was looking for percentages or a proportion or what he was looking for, I'm not sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think they're just looking for, individual and hospital mortalities for smaller aneurysms, that it's, it may be questionable that they're being done. The reason to operate on smaller aneurysms, so you understand, is if there's more rapid growth rate, so the expected growth rate of aneurysms is 0.5 to 0.7 centimeters per year. So if you see that it's growing more rapidly, because those are theoretically at higher risk, there are some studies that show if you have uncontrolled hypertension and bad COPD, you may be at higher risk, and women tend to rupture at smaller sizes than men. Or if they're symptomatic, and symptomatic gets to a fuzzy area. So I think that's those are the reasons to operate on smaller aneurysms. There are several large studies, particularly out of the UK, and that's how the 5.5 came up, because if you're under 5.5 in general, your rupture risk is between 5 and 7% per year. So you have to make sure that your risk of doing harm is less than that. So I think that basically they're just looking at the mortality rates for individuals and for hospitals.
Okay, so...
And I think they chose 30 days because, although, you know, this may change also with time, but, you know, 30 days has sort of been the standard for mortality. I know in the VA where I work, they're talking about starting to look towards 60 days. Because the question is when does the perioperative period end? But I don't even think they necessarily specified. I think in one place they specified 30 days, but in one place they said who die while in the hospital. So I guess if you're in the hospital for more than 30 days, you'd be caught. I think Dr. Rogers. I think that Dr. Rogers was the one who put that in.
I'm sorry, I missed what I said.
You said you wondered about 30 days.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, it's the issue of follow up in any setting.
Yeah.
The discordance between where the service is done and where they end up being followed.
Right.
Yeah, that's all. I mean, it's a real issue that anybody faces if they're doing even. Term follow-up is how do you get these patients?
I'm trying to find the open AAA is one is very similar. That's 1523. It's basically the same thing in hospital mortality following elective open AAAs for small aneurysms. And the reason they separated out endovascular versus open is because obviously the physiologic trauma to the body is much more severe with open, and so I think that's why they felt they needed to separate it out. I'm not going to go through all the categories again because it's basically the same setup, just looking at open versus rather than endovascular. Comments from people were, again, unclear how the measure report scoring means. I think, again, it's just mortality. They state vascular surgeons understand the scores, but it's unclear how the score is presented, if non-medical individuals would be able to interpret. And then he was making regards to harmonizing because there is a measure from the AHRQ regarding aneurysms as well. I'm not sure where he saw that comment about the vascular surgeons would understand the score, because the score is just mortality.
You should understand that.
Yeah, I know. Let's see. Other comments. Innovative way to get around the issue of risk adjustment, but not clear on the standard for mortality. What's good mortality? Yes, I think that their issue for mortality, it should be a zero. Obviously, that's a goal to reach in somebody who you're operating on, essentially for elective, and again, for smaller aneurysms, questionably. Questionably not needed surgery, so you really shouldn't be doing it on high-risk patients who are more likely to die of their comorbidities than their aneurysm. And I think that's why they left out risk adjustment, because they felt that people should be evaluating the risk prior to doing the surgery, because, again, with smaller aneurysm, your risk of rupture is lower, and so you have to make sure that your risk of doing something to them is not more than their risk of rupture. And I think that's what they're trying to capture actually is to see, make sure that people aren't doing small aneurysm repairs on incorrect patients. And everybody did, in the end, think that it should be approved as a measure. So, any other comments or questions?
None for me.
There are a couple of things that I think that you may want to follow up with them about at the meeting. One of which I'm sure you would answer for yourself, and you commented at the beginning that these are two similar measures, and the question is, would there be any value in combining them and stratifying the result in terms of having fewer measures sitting out there? So that's
I think, again, the issue is that open aneurysms are essentially even more morbid than endovascular in terms of stress on the body. And so I think they felt they needed to separate them out because it's even more crucial for open aneurysms to make sure that you're doing it on the correct patients. And I don't know that they felt it was clear that you could be, if you combine the measures, they would still want to keep the two groups separate.
And one of the other things that you mentioned was that the information comes from the a couple of very specific databases.
Mm-hmm.
And in the write-up, it talks about a registry that includes certain specific information, and then they identify that those two registries do record such information, and they just want to clarify with them that it does not have to be those two registries. They're simply saying it must be a registry that includes the information that those two include.
So you would like to see it be more than their two registries, is what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that to clarify with them whether or not one has to participate in their registries in order to use these measures.
Okay, gotcha.
And another thing for the group to take a look at is just to be sure that the responses to the questions around the specifications of the measures are clear and complete enough so that anyone applying the measure could apply it in the same way and have the likelihood of getting the same outcome if they were using the same data set. In other words, are the specifications clear and complete? And are you satisfied with the testing that's been done?
Right. Well, I think for these measures, I mean, really the data points that they're looking at specifically is basically size of the aneurysm and whether the patient dies. So I think that's fairly easy data for anybody to collect because they're not, they're looking at very specific size of aneurysms. So I think that would be easy for anybody to collect.
Okay, sure.
Since they're not doing risk adjustment, it makes it much simpler.
Okay. So then...
The other thing I would mention about open versus endovascular and nowadays, since the vast majority of aneurysm repairs are being done, there's a much higher percentage being done by endovascular. The ones that tend to be done by open are much more technically difficult. In other words, they're either perirenal or suprarenal, or they involve both iliac arteries. There's a reason why they can't be fixed in an endovascular fashion. So not only is it a more morbid procedure when you compare just routine open infrarenal aneurysms from open to endovascular, but the open ones tend now to be more complicated anatomically.
But their patients are sicker.
Yeah. Well, it's not necessarily that they're sicker, but anatomically you're going to be interfering with the renal blood flow and stuff. So even more the reason not, you know, to be very selective of who you're doing it in.
Well, will the information gathered by this process assist in the decision-making with respect to what kind of treatment to give in the future?
Yeah, I think it would. I think the idea is to sort of encourage people to really think carefully when they're operating on smaller aneurysms and not just do it, you know, because the patient has an aneurysm.
Right.
Which there is some information that they discovered as they were creating, like the New England group, but they discovered as they were creating their database that people were doing small aneurysms perhaps on inappropriate patients.
They sure have fewer complications, right? Got it.
Okay, so Terry, do you want to talk about 1531?
Yeah. So I have 1531, which the title, Follow-Up Assessment of Stroke or Death After Carotid Revascularization. You know, and as I read the brief description of the measure, it goes like this. Proportion of patients with carotid revascularization procedures who had follow-up performed for evaluation of death assessment with an IH stroke scale. And it's not clear to me as I look at that whether all they're interested in is the number of people who actually had a follow-up, or are they interested in the content of that follow-up? And looking at that brief description is something I just noticed now. Actually, it's not clear to me, or am I missing something?
Yeah, it seemed to me that they wanted to...
I think I know what they want, but
yeah.
But I don't think that the brief description of measure actually gets them there. Melinda, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I do. And so then you have to look at the numerator denominator and see if that's going to get them there, because that's where the specification, actual specification is.
Okay. So then let's go through importance to measure report. They get pretty compelling evidence that there's lots of folks out there that have the disease and have treatment for it. It sounds like the majority are open carotid endarterectomy procedures. Vivian, maybe you can help with the numbers on that.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, I think the importance of measure report is clearly met. And they describe in some detail the summary of that evidence with the guidelines and so forth and so on. Scientific acceptability, patients with documentation of a follow-up assessment between 21 and 60 days after the date of, again, it doesn't say, well, there, under one, in, so it says patient's documentation in the subgroup is neurologic status using the NIH stroke scale by an examiner was certified, and then the two vital status, alive or expired. Time windows a year, numerator details, patient status, alive or deceased, and the second is follow-up on age, stroke scale administered, yes. And under that, examiner certified, yes, should be contacted by someone other than the operator. So looks like that they are looking for two things. One is they want to make sure whoever does the evaluation is certified, and secondly, neurologic status, and I guess the third would be alive or dead. Am I missing something in there by anyone?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. All right, and so then down to is the next testing analysis, no, usability. ACCF plans to begin voluntary public reporting of NCDR managed participants. So I think this is fairly straightforward in terms of all the other usability.
The question in my mind about this measure,
Right.
What are they trying to say, that everybody needs to become certified by the American Stroke Association?
Well, that's a great question. And
because that seems to me like I don't know if the certification costs money or they have it for free. But
can I actually respond to that?
Yes.
Yeah, it is free. This is something that's online. People can just sign up for it and get it with relatively little effort and at no expense. The idea here is just to make sure that there's a consistent approach to assessing for this very important outcome after carotid revascularization, namely stroke.
Mm-hmm.
So is there something about the... Is it a process-related deal? Do you want to make sure that...
Yeah, this is a process measure. It's not an outcome measure per se. This is certainly a in terms of outcome measures, we're intent on developing a robust risk adjustment model for the outcomes, but have not yet done that to this point.
Okay, so therefore, relative to my first comment at the beginning of the discussion, then the answer would be you want to know what percentage of people are actually having this evaluation?
Yeah, we want to look at the proportion of patients, the proportion of patients who undergo carotid revascularization who are being appropriately followed for adverse outcomes following revascularization.
And this is only through the CARE registry?
At this point, yeah. I mean, that's the mechanism whereby this measure has been developed, is through the CARE registry.
Okay.
Can I add something to that?
Sure.
Yeah. The purpose for doing a carotid revascularization is to try to avoid a stroke.
Got it.
And so some assessment for that as an endpoint ought to be done. And the process measure to try to ascertain that would be to do a neurological examination at a recommended time point after performance of the procedure.
Right.
So it's the desire to try to obtain whether or not an endpoint was reached.
And it's also, the time frame is specifically designed to help, centers compare their outcomes with the randomized trials, and also to conform to guideline recommendations, which suggest that one's adverse event rate should be below a certain point if one is going to be considering carotid.
I just speak as a vascular surgeon. So the follow-up assessment, we do it as soon as they wake up or, immediately after a carotid stent. We do it before they leave the hospital and probably a week or two later. But that doesn't fall between 21 and 60 days. I was curious as to where the 21 to 60 days came
from. Well, the 30-day time frame derives largely from the trial results, again, in terms of trying to ensure comparability with one's results with those of the randomized trials. And, again, the guideline recommendations are derived in part from, complication rates vis-a-vis the this time frame.
Well, what I'm saying is if somebody does it, say 14 days, would they be picked up by this?
According to the specifications, no.
Mm-hmm.
This is Terry again. So talk a little bit more about the certified exam. I think I understand the intent to have some consistency and predictability. But if someone who is not certified does an exam and it's an appropriate exam and enters the data in the correct fashion and so forth, what happens? Will it not be utilized then or what?
Well, it looks like they actually have two data points. They have one that says, did you do an appropriate exam,
right,
which is by the NIHSS standards, and then the second one is the examiner certified?
Right, but for purposes of reporting and acknowledging what happens with the patient, if an exam is done but it's not by certified, does that nullify the fact that they had an exam?
I don't think it would nullify it. The point of breaking the question apart would be to try to obtain some assessment of how often the exams are being done and what sorts of people are doing them and whether or not they have gone through that NIHSS certification process, which is not that difficult to do. It's available online, and it's a relatively simpler thing to do. So it's really just a tabulation mechanism to try to understand the types of people doing the exams. It's not meant to either validate or invalidate the data.
Okay, so actually it's a learning tool for those in your position to say, we need to spend more time getting other people to advance a certification in our exam. Got it. Okay. So if that's the case then if it's really, we're just counting what happens, not necessarily at this point being critical of the how it's done or by whom it is done, then I think it is, for me at least, a little different take on the measure as a whole, because it really is, it sounds to me like it's a quantifying measure. It's a point in time, okay, as of this period in time, here's when the exams are being done or not being done, and here's who they're being done by. Yes? Sort of? So in that case, the feasibility, I think, is fairly straightforward. Is an exam being done, and are they alive or dead? Is an exam being done, and by whom is it being accomplished?
The question goes back to the question that we asked about the other one. How easy would that be to collect for somebody who's not participating in this registry? So if you were a hospital and you wanted to see how your surgeons were doing or your interventionalists were doing, how, since a lot of the exams take place out of the hospital and you may not have a private practitioners walking in and out, how do you document that easily between the 21 and 60-day time frame?
That's a great point.
I think it's going to vary to some extent based on, I think, certainly within, I think this is the case for any longitudinal follow-up, that within integrated healthcare systems, these things are typically feasible. Within registries, these things are typically feasible. And in sort of less integrated systems, they're less feasible. And I think that's just the practical reality of any measure that's going to try to reach beyond a specific procedure.
I'm still curious why the 21 to 60. I understand the 30 days, but I'm still curious about the 21 to 60 day time frame.
Yeah, well, we ideally would have a single. It's to provide some flexibility around the ascertainment of time. I think that, to be honest, I would imagine that. You know, those dates are negotiable, but again, it's attempting to try and standardize the ascertainment period. Certainly in hospital is not a standardized ascertainment period. It's trying to standardize the ascertainment period and allow
I would disagree with that, because, you know, the first thing we do when a patient awakes from their procedure is to assess their neurologic status, because if they're not good, you open them back up again.
Right. Well, so, but, however, that doesn't capture, some of the perioperative strokes, right? So, to use in hospital, because the variability in length of stay is not a standardized period.
Uh-huh.
And again, you don't have, to the extent that many of the trials report 30-day event rates.
Yes.
This, again, allows some comparability with that. The reason it's not 30 days on the nose is because I think we'd all acknowledge that.
No, I'm curious of the start time being 21 days. That's what I'm curious about.
It was a compromise value that was obtained after a lot of discussion as to what sort of brackets would be reasonable around 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
In order to get the flexibility to allow for all the variabilities of assessment, and a consensus opinion by those evaluating was that 21 was a reasonable.
Most of the strokes happen within the first 15 days, so that's why I was curious about the 21 start time.
Well, it would be picked up at 21 then, and presumably would be picked up at 30.
Yeah.
think we've clarified with respect to process measures. We understand there's some concern about, as with all follow-up programs, what the anticipation expectations are, whether it's an integrated system or hospital docs and so forth, and then it's a 30-day discussion. Alexis, I may be missing, or Melinda, the summary, but I don't see anything on the per-person votes that would prohibit us from passing measure. Where's the summary of the or of all the votes for each of the? Is it at the bottom of each individual measure?
No, if you're looking at it on the screen right now.
Yeah, actually, I'm not. Also, I brought up my own.
Okay, so you're looking at the spreadsheet.
Yeah.
So you're not going to see a score per se. What you're going to see in each of those yellow columns is whether or not the individual how each member of the work group evaluated the measure on the individual criterion. So the first one is scientific acceptability,
right.
And you'll see there is a range more completely, one minimally, one partially. The next one looking at usability, and then the one looking at feasibility. And I'm sorry, I missed the one looking at importance. So you will not see a score. What you see are the
visuals.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I have that. I just it's all wrapped. So
yeah.
Of the concerns that have been mentioned in the boxes, and. So my just overall, it would look, although there's concern about the 30 days and so forth, overall it looks like it would be positively supported. There's a couple minimally, there's a couple of partially. The only no I see is actually under under importance met. And Chris Sagel said, this sounds like an important process, but the link to improved outcomes is not present. One must make outcome measurement possible in order to know if outcomes are improving. So perhaps the measure should be part of a composite which measures outcomes of interest. And I think that comment, I have to interpret it, is based on the expectation that all of these measurements are outcome measurements. It's been clarified that this one, at this point in time, is a process measurement, and at least that's how I would interpret it.
Yeah.
Vivian, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it sounds like this is more a process to ensure that people who are doing these procedures are, you know, tracking their potential complications, which is appropriate.
Right. So I think that hopefully we can address his concern there. It says there's a question about unclear how the data would be publicly reported or comprehended by the public, and I don't think at this point it necessarily is aimed at the public, although...
Well, but isn't that part of the NQF thing, is that it has to be publicly reported? So, I think that's an important question if this is going to be an NQF-endorsed measure. How would the public, interpret this data? Like if you're not getting a certified examiner, does that make you getting less of care?
Perhaps the proposers could address that for us. The issue of public reporting and the likelihood of proper interpretation by the public. Is there someone still there who could do that?
Yeah, well, the there was no desire to mandate that this be a publicly reported measure. It certainly is acceptable to be one, but the drive for this was not that it was some necessity for public reporting. It's more of a compliance with process controls to looking to ensure quality performance of procedures, and then in some format close to guidelines recommendations. So the guidelines recommendations suggest that neurological exams be done following these procedures. So that was the desire. The compliance as a publicly reported measure wasn't really the background for doing this. It would not be harmful to report it publicly, on the other hand. But it wasn't anticipated that this would be and used to somehow rank different people.
Yeah.
That wasn't the intent.
I understand that. Maybe I may have misstated the question. Vivian has pointed out that it is the expectation that the measurements would be available for public viewing. And the question really is there anything in the way that this is designed, or particularly or the displaying part, that you'd have concerns about that it might be, if not interpreted correctly, it might be misinterpreted? And I think you pretty much answered the question. It wasn't designed to publicly expose, but there would be no issue in having it available for public viewing if that was the...
That's correct. And I think most publicly reported measures of almost anything have to be explained and presented the correct way. This one would be no different. But again, you're right, that wasn't the intent.
It's Melinda. I need to clarify one thing that related to precisely to what you're talking about. The comment was made earlier, isn't that the expectation of NQF-endorsed measures? And in fact, measures that are submitted for endorsement are to be identified as an intended use, both public reporting and quality improvement. And this measure and all the SVS measures were submitted and identified that the intended use of the measures included both public reporting and quality improvement. My belief is that these measures are not widely used at this point, but that would still be the intended use as designated by SVS, and if they were not being publicly reported at the time of endorsement, at the very next interval when they were being reevaluated, the question would be what has been done in terms of moving them into public reporting. So just need to be prepared for responding to that at the steering committee meeting.
Okay. I think that brings us back to, let's see what else here. I'm not sure I understand Dr. Sagal's comment about should be part of a composite. I assume it would mean it would be tagged onto a...
I think, he was thinking that I think it goes back to the other thing that they were thinking it should be part of a quality measure rather than a process measure. So it's clarified that this is really a process improvement rather than a outcomes measure.
Right. Okay. Other than that, I think it's there. I have nothing else.
Okay, so we do not have the lead discussant for 357, 359, 1540 or 1543. So the two of you who are on the phone who are members of the work group have full latitude to decide how you want to approach these. Do you want to take a look at them? Do you want to say you will forego them and wait for discussion at the steering committee? Are there any comments that you want to talk about together with respect to any of these four measures?
Well, we might take a minute and just look at what some of the comments are. For instance, if we go to I'm looking at the first one on the list is 357.
Mm-hmm.
And that is abdominal aortic aneurysm volume.
Vivian has made a comment. Actually, Vivian, I don't need to speak for you. You can just...
Yes, I always have a problem with volume alone being used as a quality measure. Because I think in many cases it's the process, and then where do you set your volume standards? Because in different places and in different countries, you know, high volume may be vary. And plus there's a lot of data. There's now some papers that have been out recently. I think I put one of them in there that... for endovascular aneurysms, volume actually may not be an issue. You only need to do 10, and above 10, it doesn't make a difference. So, I just have a problem with it being as a standalone quality measure.
Right.
And how that gets interpreted by the public.
Is the proposer on the call?
No, I think they weren't on the phone.
That's right. Is this ARC?
Yes,
or?
It's ARC. And, you know, the data that they were quoting about volumes is older than some of the newer, you know, data that's around.
Right. I think you gave a reference.
And scoring out ruptured versus non-ruptured, I mean, you know, a rupture is just a completely different beast than an elective aneurysm. And that's for the other aneurysm measure, too. And endovascular versus open, as I said earlier, for the SVS measures, the opens now tend to be more complicated cases. So I think, again, the older literature that they presented don't reflect the reality of now. Because in the, you know, maybe even as recently as, you know, 6-7 years ago before, you know, endovasculars have really peaked out over the last, like, say, you know, 7 years or so, you know, you had more routine infrarenal open aneurysms being done. Now they're very few and far between, and any open aneurysms tend to be patients who are complicated anatomically for an endovascular repair.
Yeah.
So I think that that's a very different beast. So I also have an issue with not separating those out.
Right. Okay. Well, I don't know how you want to handle this, Melinda. There's two of us, one who is completely naive and one who's an expert. We should give voice or allow voice of the other people who have comments. So I'm not sure how much more we can help with these in a way that has any substance.
Yeah, it'd be nice. It's too bad. You know, at least if they can comment on the comments from the other reviewers like Chris.
Right.
Has a long comment here that I can't see the whole thing for some reason.
On 48 or 57.
On 59, it's under rationale for ratings for importance.
It's
talking about signal and...
Oh, that's 59. Where is it? Oh, here it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So, Jessica, if you can click on that, you probably can see the whole thing.
So, it's, Vivian, it's under what...
It's on 0359, and it's under Chris Segal.
Right, got that.
Under the two category.
Okay.
It's like a very long thing, but I can't see all of it.
Okay, so it's regarding risk stratification. Several approaches are mentioned in the document, which is confusing. 2A.14 lists age, gender, and other vascular procedures. In the data testing section below, a CMS-based model includes many other factors, which is proposed. Also, in 2B3, there is a sentence fragment that identifies a low signal from provider data regarding provider mortality. This, I see where you are. And it goes on and on.
Yeah, this is, he has some...
Hi, this is Jessica. I can tell you that after you stopped reading, it just says this needs to be clarified.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Thank you. That helps. Now that I just disrupted my database. Okay. And I think it would be best to give him an opportunity to speak to that directly.
And then, because he also says they comment on usability study, but the results are somewhat cryptically stated.
Right.
So those will, of course, be the opportunity to discuss those at the steering committee as a whole. And going back to the comment about being concerned about the volume measure being reported alone, I will tell you that when these two measures were initially endorsed, they were recommended and it was put into the report that it was recommended that they be reported together, that volume not be reported alone.
Okay.
And I think that's what you'll hear from ARC, that that's the way they're being reported.
So then why should there be two separate measures then?
Good question for the steering committee discussion.
Okay.
And then also we have to harmonize them with the SBS ones, although they are not doing a size limit. But so you could say that they're slightly different. But... And it would be nice also, I have to say, to know a little bit more about their risk-adjusted model.
And we do expect that they will be present at the steering committee meeting to be able to respond to those questions and provide you the additional information. I thought I heard Jessica.
Yeah,
Melinda,
this is Eileen. I didn't know if you wanted me to do 1548.
Yes.
Should I go ahead and do that one now?
Sure.
Okay. So this one is on the surveillance of an endovascular abdominal aortic aneurysm repair, I guess is referred to as EVAR. And the suggestion is to complete an imaging study after 3 months and within 15 months of the initial procedure. And I think the team generally felt that this was of importance as there's potential complications if the initial procedure isn't monitored after completion. And there were some examples there that were given as far as what kind of complications would possibly come about without proper follow-up. And let's see. The measure was proposed without any type of risk adjustment. The usability, it was noted that it's currently in use. I guess the way that the information is collected today has to be entered within the quality registry, which I think was discussed earlier. So there were some comments that were made by some of the team members regarding the use of the registry and that being a possible limitation, I guess, to the measure.
I think that this... this measure is something like the exams after carotids. You know, for an endovascular aneurysm repair, you can have endo leaks. The sac may not be clearly completely sealed. You may have, and the leaks can, some of the leaks, there's four types of endo leaks, proximal distal attachment sites, between the pieces of the graft as they get put together and from branch vessels, and then actually through the graft itself, serum can leak. And all those may pressurize the aneurysm and lead to late ruptures. And so this, the whole point of fixing the aneurysm is to prevent ruptures, so you have to keep an eye on these. And the way to do that is with CAT scans. And while the registry, this is done by the registry, really anybody who's performing an endovascular repair should have some means of making sure that they have follow-ups done. And I think part of the concern was that patients get lost to follow-up for their endovascular aneurysm repairs and present with complications and at a time when they may not be so easy to fix. So I think it is an important process improvement. I agree with the comment of it's not clear to me either about public reporting of who's not following up on their patients kind of thing and how it would be publicly reported, just as with the carotid measure. So I think that's an important question to bring back to the sponsors.
Is ARC sponsor this one also?
No, this is SVS, I think. I'm pretty sure this is SVS.
My suspicion is your answer would be pretty much the same. It wasn't actually intended necessarily for. It was just a starting place to get numbers to move ahead, see how many getting this done. And I think the same argument made that could this be part of a group of things that are measured rather than a standalone. So.
So, it looked like, Eileen, like most people had approved it.
Right.
But I think we did all wonder about the, several people did comment about the public reporting.
Right. So I guess that would be the question we would want raised as well as the use of the registry or...
Again, I think that the endpoints are pretty simple. Either you followed up or you didn't.
Right.
So anybody should be able to do it.
Right.
It shouldn't necessarily need a registry to tell you that. And really, if you're doing an EVAR, you have to have some mechanism where you are. I mean, I can tell you again, I work in the VA system, so there are more complex endovascular aneurysms that my particular VA is not capable of handling, so I'll send them to San Francisco. But I always communicate with them so they know when we've done the follow-up CAT scans for them and they know if there's any issues. So they're still making sure that they have knowledge of what's happening to the patient's follow-up.
Right. But, of course, you have a system that allows that to occur.
Yes. But I think the idea is that everybody should have a system that allows that to occur because it's not that hard.
Well, yeah.
To me, actually, it actually could be a thing for socioeconomic reasons, especially the larger academic centers have a lot of people referred to them that may be coming at quite a distance.
Right.
And obviously, if you have to keep coming back for CAT scans, that may not be so easy for patients to do. So how they track those patients may be important as well.
Right.
Yeah, I thought that was a good point that you had made. As far as the possible impact to the different populations.
Yeah. Okay, and what we have, what's left?
1540 and 1543, postoperative stroke or death in asymptomatic patients undergoing carotid endarterectomy, that's 40, and undergoing carotid artery stenting is 43.
So again, stroke or death. I actually don't know if the SVS database requires the use of the neurologic assessment in terms of strokes that the other measure requires. So that would be an interesting question since it's a sort of related issue. Again, I think they tried to keep it relatively simple in terms of the endpoints they were looking at. It doesn't seem like they were risk adjusting. I'm hearing Hello, is somebody speaking?
Sounds like a...
a background?
Background.
Okay. I mean, again, the two measures are similar. One's for stenting, one's for open. I think, again, they separated it out because of the differences in risk. Interestingly, most the two largest recent multi-center and in some in the case of ICCS multinational trial, stenting has a higher stroke rate. Although stenting may have in the CREST trial, the American trial, it may have a lower perioperative morbidity mortality related to cardiac issues. So I think that's why they separated them out, as opposed to just combining the two revascularizations, two methods of revascularization. Again, since it's simple, it should be easy for other people to set up a database that's similar. And I don't think that they, if my memory serves me right, I don't think they risk adjusted these.
No, they did not.
Again, I think they're trying to keep the endpoints simple.
Right.
I think it looks like most of us thought they were valid measures. Let's see. Are there any major comments here? No, that's the other one. Let's see. There we go. It is unclear to me how the one-year period of asymptomatic status pre-op is determined by the author's reference to CPT code. I would assume that such a status is different, how no data is presented to assure how accurately vascular surgeons apply the CP code when billing. Again, I think they were using their databases, so I don't think they were going off of billing data.
Right.
So, how unclear how these would be ported to the public. Again, this issue of needs to be a registry member for this data be collected routinely. Yes, for this measure, but I don't think that you have to be they're using the registries, but I don't think you have to be a registry member to collect this fairly simple data. I do think it'd be nice to define, the assessment of stroke afterwards, but that gets a little bit more complicated. Any other comments from anybody?
No, not for me.
Process says the most important outcomes happen immediately pre-op. There's a comment by Dr. Segal on one of them, which I guess applies to both. The sponsor state, it's important to have, I think he must mean post-op. While other measures say that the average length of stay is 1 day, so I must look at 30-day data.
That's on 43, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think what they're concerned about is that they're not, they're only looking at the in-hospital perioperative problems or periprocedural problems. It says perioperative stroke or death, but then they say in their brief description the measure that the patient who experienced stroke or death during their hospitalizations for this procedure, but the procedure most carotid stents go home the next day, and CEAs also stay only 1 or 2 days. Again, I think they were trying to keep it simple, but the question is, does that capture all those who have periprocedural stroke or death?
Yeah.
And it goes back to the other measure, the not competing per se, but the process measure of measuring it at the 30-day mark.
Right.
So that might be brought back to the sponsors.
Right.
Because it looks like some people were concerned about the fact that they weren't measuring 30 days. They were only measuring in hospital, and in hospital is a day or two for most people.
Right. It seems like they're with the prior one, it's like some of their measures, it's like we want to make sure you're out far enough. As you just point out, if it's a 1 or 2 day hospitalization, does that allow people to sort of brush off the rest? I don't understand exactly why we need to have this if you're doing a follow up that's longer. Is it just to differentiate when the adverse event might occur?
Well, I would certainly say that most periprocedurally related neurologic events happen almost almost immediately. It can happen; they're usually within the first 48 hours. So, but with a carotid stent, you might not see that till later on. Now, there is some that occur later on. There's a small percentage that occur later on, which I think why the gold standard is 30 days.
Right.
So the question is, can they add that in? I mean, I think the registry, I haven't been told whether I can use the SVS registry from the VA system, but having seen it online, it does include a 30-day follow-up.
Right.
So if they're using their registries, I don't see why they couldn't add that in.
Yeah. And you made a comment that hospitalization duration is variable. And so if you just use your measurement tool at the time when you're in the hospital and you routinely discharge at 18 hours and some other hospital does 36 hours.
Right.
It changes.
Yes.
Denominator. Melinda, there's also a typo under D.2, brief description of measure. Second line, it should be 120 days immediately preceding, not proceeding.
Are you talking about on the...
On the measure descriptive, sorry. Yeah, I'm looking at on the measure itself.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
I just happen to have it up in front of me. It's no big deal. It's just...
I mean, I think it's important to track particularly asymptomatic patients because asymptomatic carotids, there's increasing literature that's going to probably make a lot of asymptomatic carotid procedures go away because of better medical management. Because it's comparing medical management to procedural management. So if you're doing an asymptomatic carotid, they have to live 5 years in order to benefit from a procedure.
Right. It's just sort of a spill down from the coronary artery medical versus intervention.
Yeah, kind of. It's been the original studies looking at intervention for carotids, and stenting went off those trials initially as proof that you need a stent. So it applies to both procedures. Were done in the late 1990s.
Yeah.
And so statins were just beginning to come out at that time, and Plavix also was – we had Tyclid, but we didn't really have Plavix. So the best medical management was really mostly aspirin and beta blockers and lisinopril and things like that. So I think the medical management has improved, and so the question will be – the question that has come up in our meetings, in the SVS meetings, is – which asymptomatic carotids truly benefit from a prophylactic procedure? And that question is unclear at this time.
Yeah, as you pointed out earlier, the whole idea of this is to prevent stroke. So if you're doing something that has a higher risk of stroke than the patient would have had if left alone, then it's pretty
yes.
much fine.
And that's the big question, because the asymptomatic trial, the ACAS trial, doesn't have, you know, it clearly showed that it doesn't have, if they're symptomatic, it's a completely different story, but if they're asymptomatic, it's a prophylactic procedure, and so it had to beat out medical management, which in the ACAS trial it did. In the VA trial that preceded the ACAS trial, it wasn't quite as clear, but there was a slight benefit. But, you know, again, medical management has changed, so the question is, you know, being raised again, which is better, and
right.
then which asymptomatic patients. So people are looking at, like, plaque configuration, degree of stenosis, age of the patient. You have to look at their comorbidities. You have to make sure, again, that, you know, with these asymptomatic patients, that your risk of your procedure is not greater than their risk of stroke.
That's bad form.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, is there more that needs to be done, Melinda?
No, other than that we need to go to member and public comment. In 1 second, I did want to just because you made note of the typo, and I see that. I think everybody knows this, but I just want to be clear that N2F staff do not prepare these documents. They're imported directly from what the developers submit. So to the extent that you're looking for something, and again, this doesn't go to the typo. It goes to the content of all of the measure evaluation forms that you see. Those are direct imports from the developer's submissions.
Okay. Well, I know that you never would have put proceeding when it should have been.
I wouldn't bet on that. I've done worse. But truly, that wasn't the point I was trying to make. Just to be certain that folks know that this hasn't been filtered through in QF. What they're seeing is the developer's submission.
Got it. Okay.
So I guess, Jessica, then we're ready for public and member comment.
Is there anyone on the call who would like to make a comment about today's discussion? Okay. Well, next steps, we have our in-person meeting next Wednesday and Thursday, May 4th and 5th, and everyone should have received an email from me on Tuesday with a logistics memo outlining the schedule for the meeting and the goals and objectives of the meeting. If you did not receive that email on Tuesday, which was in a PDF format, the materials were, please let me know and I can forward you that email.
I got mine.
Okay, great. Are there any questions about the upcoming meeting?
Oh, pretty straightforward. I do have a question of Vivian, however.
Yes.
Have you read the book My Stroke of Insight?
No.
It's by a lady named Jill Taylor, PhD neuroanatomist, who had a aneurysm pop in her left hemisphere, and it documents her story back to complete recovery.
Wow.
I highly recommend it.
Okay.
My Stroke of Insight.
Sounds very interesting.
Yeah.
Are there any other comments or questions? Okay, great. Well, I appreciate everyone participating on today's call, and we will see everyone next week.
Okay.
Great weekend.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you, everyone. That does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation.